issues from a superior point of view. If I were a king of the pancakes, not crepes, not waffles, not silk.
It's the wacky antics of the Twin Ports Rubber Chicken Theater, and they're celebrating 20 years of the Chicken Hat Plays. But first, a court victory for Native Americans in their dispute over the Line 5 pipeline.
The Bad River is literally only about 11 feet away from the pipe. You know, there's a lot at stake.
We agree with the judge that the pipeline can continue to operate safely, although we do disagree with the judge's interpretation of the contract that Enbridge and the band signed in 1992.
We'll hear from both sides and dissect the judge's ruling. Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. After 4 years of wrangling through the court system, a federal lawsuit filed by the Bad River Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa, against Enbridge Energy was decided in the tribe's favor last week. On June 16th, U.S. District Judge William Conley found that Enbridge has been trespassing on reservation land and ordered the company to pay the band $5.1 million. He also directed Enbridge to remove its controversial Line 5 oil and gas pipeline from tribal lands it had been illegally operating on. The company has 3 years to do so, but the dispute goes back a decade, when Enbridge's easements on a dozen parcels of land expired in 2013, and the tribe refused to renew them. WPR News reporter Danielle Kading has been covering the story for much of that time, and she's here to tell us what the ruling means. We'll also hear from a representative from Enbridge. But first, our Mike Wiggins, chairman of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa, and Whitney Gravel, president of Michigan's Bay Mills Indian Community, who spoke with my WPR colleague Kate Archer-Kent just days before the ruling. Here's their conversation.
I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Enbridge's Line 5 pipeline. It carries crude oil and natural gas liquids from its terminal in Superior to Canada. Enbridge says Line 5 is a vital piece of energy infrastructure for 70 years. We hear from leaders of Indigenous communities who say this pipeline threatens their health and safety and that of other communities in its 645-mile path. Whitney Gravel is president of the Executive Council on behalf of Bay Mills Indian Community, serves as commissioner on the Michigan Advisory Council on Environmental Justice and the board of directors of the Intertribal Council of Michigan. Whitney, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. And Mike Wiggins Jr. with us, chairman of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. Mike, welcome back.
Yeah, thank you. It's an honor to be here, and good morning.
Good morning. We're going to start with litigation. Mike, you first. The Bad River Band filed its lawsuit against Enbridge in 2019. Bad River Tribe suing to shut down, remove Line 5 from your tribal lands. How do you feel about where this lawsuit stands in terms of what you seek to accomplish?
Well, we're still awaiting decision, so I should probably be mindful of that. But, all indications are that the judge understands there's a trespass that's occurring. He has, for the most part, indicated he's going to uphold the trespass, which essentially puts forward that notion that Enbridge does not have a legal right to be where they're at inside our reservation. And so underneath that umbrella of trespass, there's still a nuisance claim, which is a legal term that gets at the impacts that the line has on our reservation, land, water, and people. You could look at those impacts through a whole multitude of lenses, from the mini industrialization of sites as they chase anomalies, which are otherwise essentially potential failure sites within the pipe, and there's dozens and dozens of those, or the low-grade stress of having the river pounding away at the pipeline right away to where, at the meander, the Bad River is literally only about 11 feet away from the pipe. And it's a powerful river, and flood scenarios, there's a lot at stake with what's going on at the right in the riverbed of the Bad River.
You've had such erosion concerns as well.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot at stake in terms of things washing out very quickly, and so there's when you live here and it's your forever home, there's always the stress and the worry of what's taking place, you know, ecologically and how that's going to impact, you know, the potential release of oil into our waterways. So that's all part of that nuisance bundle.
Whitney Gravel, can you carry this on to focus on the Bay Mills Indian community filing suit against Enbridge? And what do you see as part of your community in line five?
Yeah, so Bay Mills Indian community is actually involved in two permit processes as well as two litigation strategies that are taking place involving the Line 5 dual pipelines. One of those is we are an intervening party before the Michigan Public Service Commission, which is the body here in the state of Michigan that will decide whether or not the Line 5 dual pipelines can be placed in a tunnel beneath the Straits of Mackinac. And the other litigation that is taking place is a contested case petition that is occurring before the state agency, Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy Department for the state of Michigan, who has issued one of the first permits to Enbridge Energy to build a tunnel beneath the Straits of Mackinac. In addition to that, Bay Mills Indian community has also participated as an amici in the state of Michigan's litigation against Enbridge, which is concerning the easement revocation and protection of the public trust that the state of Michigan is trying to leverage in order to not only protect tribal nations in the state of Michigan, but also to protect the state itself and the Great Lakes and our water and land. So when it comes to Line 5, there's so much that's going on, but ultimately, I think our tribal nations and our Indigenous communities are trying to stay involved so that we can protect the Great Lakes for everyone.
When you say digging a pipeline tunnel beneath the Straits of Mackinac, take us more deeply into what the challenge of this is, because it's been called an untested tunnel, and this is a massive concrete tunnel that the Public Service Commission in Michigan is assessing in terms of, you know, giving the permit. What can you tell us?
Yeah, so not only has this design of the tunnel ever been done anywhere else in the world, there are significant concerns raised to the actual ability of the tunnel to protect and prevent the Line 5 dual pipelines from destroying the Great Lakes. In the Michigan Public Service proceedings, we have had expert witness testimony that from pipeline and tunnel experts that have identified huge concerns with methane gases getting into the tunnel and causing a catastrophic explosion that would then not only blow up the tunnel, but blow up the pipeline and ultimately blow up the Straits of Mackinac. And so although the tunnel is being presented as this win for everyone and that it's going to protect the Great Lakes or protect the Straits of Mackinac, it actually isn't. And what it also fails to take into consideration is that the Line 5 dual pipelines have already spilled more than 1.1 million gallons of crude product throughout the state of Michigan in areas other than the Straits of Mackinac. So the Straits is a very vital point. It is probably the most dangerous part of the pipeline currently in existence, but the tunnel isn't going to protect the pipeline from all the other harm that it's going to cause throughout the Great Lakes.
Mike Wiggins, chair of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, when you hear about a proposal like this and trying to create a tunnel to make something more safe, what comes to mind for you leading an Indigenous community?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is extremism. You know, untested, unproven extremism that's absolutely for private corporate profit. And so there's, you know, we're talking about the freshwater stronghold of America, in addition to that being the ceded territory of the Ojibwe or Anishinaabe people. But it's extremism. And the Mackinac Straits are a power place rooted in the center of the Great Lakes. our particular issue in Bad River is a power place rooted in that connectivity of 47% of the wetlands of Lake Superior in the Caucagan Bad River wetlands, just downstream from the point of failure of the Line 5. It's rooted in the Apostle Islands and that unbelievable archipelago coastal wetland realm that's here. And so you have two incredibly powerful areas that are crucial to Lake Superior and the Great Lakes being threatened with extremist kind of practices on an outdated pipe that is beyond its life. And that's part of the other scene here is that there will be a perpetual dance with failure points called anomalies, you know, if they would be allowed to continue. But the other piece that comes to mind is that there's a cumulative impact to the totality of the line that can't be ignored. And when you look at the overall impacts that are occurring and the threats, there isn't much applicability. I didn't see much applicability in court, nor in any economic development schemas. But the cumulative impacts and threats that the line represents to water and to the expanse of the line is, you know, it's at a point where it's probably best to just shut it down. We did see in court that the experts talked about under oath how it would take about a year for the market to adjust, while during that year there would be a negligible impact on the average American. So, you know, we're in a capitalist powerhouse here in America, and the market's ready for that. It would take about a year to adjust, and life would go on. Enbridge is pretty misleading with this notion that, you know, all of a sudden your lights wouldn't come on or you wouldn't be able to heat your house or something like that. Their experts never got to those types of points under oath.
The Bad River Ban declined some of Enbridge's proposals to slow erosion around the Line 5. Why did the tribe decline Enbridge's proposals?
Well, the first proposal that we put forward from the beginning was that Enbridge, since Enbridge was in trespass and they had no legal right to be in our land and water, that they shut down and purge and remove the threat. That proposal has been rejected. When we went through a series of of requests just to see what their shutdown protocol looked like under different flood scenarios, we never got an answer. And so we went through a lot trying to get at the notion of protecting water. But when you look at the proposals that have been put forward by Enbridge, they're pockmarked with shoddiness, pockmarked with untested, extreme, industrialized kind of remedies for what's occurring at the site. The site happens to be in probably the zenith of river morphology on our reservation, meaning it is a very dynamic, really powerful area where the river jumps around in the river bottom a lot. And it's actually part of the whole scenario is of why the river is pounding away and about to unseat the pipe and all the earth around it. Mm. But industrializing that pristine area is always vetted through a lens of water quality impacts, and that gets into our water quality standards and all those thoughts about downstream resources. And none of those proposals really passed muster in terms of what they were designed to do. They were questionable, and they were really, really heavy-handed in the environmental impacts.
Mike Wiggins, Jr., chairman of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. We have Whitney Gravel with us, president of the Bay Mills Indian Community Executive Board in Michigan. Whitney, along the lines of treaty recognition, Enbridge releasing a plan last year, calling it a reconciliation plan to integrate Indigenous rights and knowledge into our business across Turtle Island, it says. What do you make of this plan?
The plan for me is just another PR stunt by Enbridge. You can't engage in reconciliation when you are still actively harming Indigenous communities. And understanding the law, understanding the rights that should be afforded to tribal nations, it rings and echoes hollow when Enbridge wants to say that they respect tribes or that they respect treaty rights, or that they respect the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, but then ignore tribes when they are asking for Enbridge to leave their lands, to leave their waters, to respect and honor their treaty rights and not jeopardize them. And so for me, it's just another PR stunt, and it doesn't mean anything, because if you really meant what you were saying, you would not be continuing to harm us even today in your operation of Line 5. If you really respected Indigenous communities, you would listen to what we're saying when we tell you that you need to decommission Line 5 in order to protect the Great Lakes for everyone. If you respected tribal nations, you would not engage in massive amounts of donations and money and public relations stunts in order to undermine Indigenous voices. And so for me, it means nothing, because I believe in actions, not only words. And Enbridge has proven time and time again that they are not to be trusted, and that they don't actually care about tribal nations, Indigenous communities, or the people of the Great Lakes.
Mike Wiggins, Jr., is a full shutdown of Line 5 the best path forward?
Well, our efforts in Bad River are focused on protecting our nation's treaty-reserved water rights realm. We're in our forever home. We need our groundwater aquifers to be clean. That's where all of our communities' wells are tapped into. And what's happening on the surface in the Bad River is an imminent threat. We went to an emergency injunction court hearing the other day, and kind of got scolded by the judge as though couldn't understand why we haven't acted like a responsible pipeline company as a tribal nation. But our effort is to protect our water, and I would say this, I sat with an Enbridge official. He had a map he wanted to show me. What he brought out was a USGS groundwater map, and he told me that their product's presence in groundwater aquifers really doesn't amount to pollution. And so I'll submit that for lack of integrity and lack of reconciliation. It's not a very good prospect.
Mike Wiggins, their chairman of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, Whitney Gravel, president of the Bay Mills Indian Community Executive Board in Michigan. Thank you both.
That was Mike Wiggins, chairman of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, and Whitney Gravel, president of Michigan's Bay Mills Indian Community, speaking with my WPR colleague, Kate Archer Kent, just days before a judge's ruling in favor of the band in its lawsuit against Enbridge Energy. Coming up, an Enbridge executive responds, and we dissect the court's decision. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. We're talking about the ruling last week by U.S. District Judge William Conley, finding for the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa in its lawsuit against Enbridge Energy. I'm joined now by Paul Eberth, Enbridge's Director of Tribal Engagement for the U.S., and also WPR reporter Danielle Kading, who's been long covering the dispute. Welcome to Simply Superior, everyone.
Hi, Robin.
Good morning.
Paul Eberth, what's Enbridge's response both to the concerns we just heard of the Native leaders and also to Judge Conley's ruling?
Yeah, I think, Robin, I appreciate having the input from the Indigenous leaders on your show. Enbridge is focused on delivering positive outcomes for both tribes and businesses. And I think our track record speaks to that, Robin. Regarding easement matters, Enbridge has renewed easements for pipeline operations in Minnesota, in Wisconsin, and in Oklahoma, all in the last a few years. We've developed an Indigenous Reconciliation Action Plan, which lays out commitments for the business, commitments that I'm proud to say that we're making really good progress on, commitments that involve the inclusion of Indigenous people in our business. So we have Indigenous employees working for us. Commitments around community engagement and investment in Indigenous communities. The economic inclusion piece, Robin, has been a significant part of our business. For example, on Line 3 replacement in Minnesota, we spent more than $400 million with Indigenous-owned businesses on the project and on Indigenous labor. And even as of recent, we've had First Nations and tribes on both sides of the border in Canada and the U.S. start to participate as owners in our business. 23 First Nations are now part owners of our pipeline system in Alberta. Enbridge sold a pipeline actually just last week to the MHA Nation in North Dakota. We have four First Nation owners in the development of a carbon capture project that we're doing. So I think we're making a really good progress on our Indigenous Reconciliation Action Plan. And we're excited about where we're going. We know we have challenges in front of us still. And you heard from some Indigenous leaders last week who spoke to some of those challenges, but we do think that there's real opportunity in the future for both Enbridge and tribes.
Mm-hmm. And what is your response to the ruling?
Robin, we agree with the judge that the pipeline can continue to operate safely and that the conditions at the meander along the Bad River are not cause for immediate shutdown. Although we do disagree with the judge's interpretation of the contract that Enbridge and the band signed in 1992, which provided an obligation and a commitment to allow for 50 years of safe operation of the pipeline on the reservation. In fact, the judge said at one point during the trial that Enbridge is in substantial compliance with the majority of the pipeline crossing of the band lands. And while there are some expired easements today, we do believe that the band has an obligation and signed a contract with us to allow for operations for 50 years.
Mm-hmm. So, Danny, you have some specific questions.
Yeah, thank you, Robin. Paul, you know, the judge gave Enbridge a 3-year time frame for shutting down Line 5 on the tribe's reservation. I mean, what's your response to that time frame, and how could that affect the Line 5 reroute project?
Well, we think the 3-year time frame is arbitrary. Again, the band signed a contract with us in 1992 that we believe provides an obligation for them to work with us for the safe operations and continued operations of the pipeline to 2043. Regarding the ability to complete the relocation project, we filed environmental applications for the relocation project in 2020. And we believe it's very possible for the regulatory agencies to permit the relocation project in this 3-year time frame. And we're prepared to build the project. We've purchased pipe for the relocation project. We've acquired all of the easements needed for the relocation project, so no condemnation will be needed. We were able to acquire these easements from private and public landowners along the entire relocation project. So we're ready to go to remove the pipeline operations from the reservation, but believe that the band should and is obligated to continue to work with us on the safe operations until the pipeline can be relocated.
And as far as, you know, how things are going currently, can you talk at all about how you've been working with the DNR and the Army Corps on your proposed reroute and where things stand?
Well, I can say that we submitted our permit applications. We did that a couple years ago, and it is in the hands of the DNR and the Army Corps to move the application project or process forward. We continue to provide information when requested by those agencies. The Department of Natural Resources in Wisconsin is putting together an environmental impact statement, often called an EIS. And we believe that the Department of Natural Resources will complete that environmental impact statement by the end of the year and then can move forward with the permitting.
And related to what the judge had said about, you know, replacing it within this 3-year time frame, what are your concerns if this project isn't permitted and completed by that date?
Well, we believe that, again, we have the right to continue to operate the pipeline on the reservation. We think we'll appeal, you know, the judge's order around 3 years and his interpretation that those rights have expired. But in the meantime, we're going to continue to pursue the relocation project, and we're ready to build it as soon as possible.
And the pipeline were shut down across the tribe's reservation or elsewhere. You know, I know you're facing legal challenges in the Straits of Mackinac as well. What kind of impact would that have on the upper Midwest and, you know, the regional economies?
You know, we believe the impacts are real. In fact, there were people that testified from refineries and provided input into the impacts that they would see. But Line 5 delivers critical energy supplies to the Midwest and beyond. Propane for Wisconsin, the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, Minnesota, Lower Peninsula of Michigan, and crude oil supplies that go to refineries throughout the Midwest, Eastern Canada, and into New York. And taking out 500,000 barrels per day of supply would require that supply to be delivered by other means, which come with impacts in and of themselves. So the impacts would be real. In fact, I think that's why you've seen Canada, the country of Canada, trigger the transit treaty and engage in a diplomatic exchange with the United States to ensure that that the pipeline stays in operation.
Well, then, you know, just related to the window that the judge has set, and, he said in his ruling that this 3 years gives the market and public time to adjust or gives Enbridge time to pursue an appeal or seek new law. Would Enbridge consider pursuing any new legislation or law to get this built?
You know, Enbridge is going to appeal. I don't know of any plans to seek a new law, but... in the end, I think the courts will have to make a decision around what the commitments were in Enbridge and the Vans 1992 contract and weigh the importance of that with respect to the ongoing pipeline operations.
Is there anything that we haven't asked you that you would want to add about the judge's ruling or the project?
Well, I think the judge's ruling had a lot of information around erosion potential along the Bad River associated with Enbridge's current operations. And I think we just shouldn't lose sight of the fact that prudent maintenance needs to be done along Line 5 on the Bad River Reservation to ensure safe operations. So Enbridge is also focused on putting forward and completing erosion mitigation projects that we've done in many other jurisdictions like riprap along the riverbank, or tree or natural timber revetment along a riverbank to prevent further erosion so that we can ensure safe operations of the pipeline, keep the river safe, keep the environment safe until the relocation project is completed.
We've been speaking with Paul Ebert. He's the Director of Tribal Engagement for the United States for Enbridge Energy. Thank you for joining us, Paul.
Yeah, thank you, Robin.
So, Danny, tell us what transpired with Judge Conley's ruling and what it all means.
Sure, Robin. So the ruling basically says that Enbridge has to remove its oil and gas pipeline from lands where it's been found to be illegally operating on the Bad River Tribe's reservation within 3 years. And in addition to that, the judge is ordering Enbridge to pay $5.1 million for trespassing on the tribe's reservation. And this all comes, nearly 4 years after the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa first filed their federal lawsuit. And essentially it means that within 3 years' time, pending any appeals or any federal intervention or unforeseen circumstances, that line could be shut down on about a dozen parcels where the judge found that Enbridge is in fact trespassing because easements for the pipeline expired on those lands back in 2013.
And as we heard, Enbridge says they will appeal. When do you think the appeal will be heard and by whom? And how far up the courts can it go?
Well, that's a good question, Robin. There's a step or two first before we would get to that point. For one, the judge has given Enbridge and Bad River until today to seek any clarification about his order. And then he'll enter a final judgment. Basically, once he's done that, then Enbridge can seek an appeal. And I believe that usually happens within 90 days or less. So that's the timeline that they have to essentially get their plea in to put a hold on the judge's ruling. And if that were to happen, it would essentially extend that clock, that three-year time frame that the judge has set in this case for a removal of Line 5 on those contested parcels.
And how far could it go? Perhaps the Supreme Court?
I think that's entirely possible. You know, I wouldn't rule anything out. We would see this, of course, if this goes to appeal, then it would go to the Federal Court of Appeals. And we've seen before that the U.S. Supreme Court has taken up cases from the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. So it's entirely possible. We just saw a recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling that challenged Native American rights related to the Indian Child Welfare Act. So I think it's entirely possible that could happen. It just remains to be seen what the next step is. I certainly think that Enbridge has made it clear that they're willing to take this all the way. And I think Bad River, for its part, has said that they intend to fight this to the end to protect their watershed and Lake Superior and their tribal resources.
All right. We've been joined by Danielle Kading, Superior-based reporter for WPR News, who's been long covering the dispute between the Bad River Band and Enbridge Energy. Thank you for joining us, Danny.
Thanks for having me on, Robin.
Coming up, 8 writers creating 8 plays for 8 world premieres in 24 hours.
If I were a king of the pancakes, not crepes, not waffles, not silk, I'd serve other things with my pancakes. A 1 bacon, a 1 sausage, a 1 milk.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. That pancake-flavored parody is courtesy of the Twin Ports Rubber Chicken Theater, which is celebrating 20 years of something they call the Chicken Hat Plays. It's a single performance for which they've tapped 8 writers and 8 directors to create 8 world premiere plays in 24 hours. That was exhausting, they said, but it hasn't completely worn them out. Since then, they've created 311 one-act plays by an equal number of writers and directors and hundreds more actors. And they'll do it again tomorrow night, June 24th, at Harbor City International School in Duluth. Here to tell us about it is Rubber Chicken's Brian Matuszak. Welcome to Simply Superior, Brian.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So I want to get to the obvious question, which is why. But first, tell me about the Rubber Chicken Theater and what you normally present, if
sure.
Anything you do is called normal.
Yeah. Well, it's a fun theater company. We do a lot of different things. We do scripted comedies, scripted plays. You know, this November we're going to be doing a one-woman show called What the Constitution Means to Me, and that's going to be a lot of fun. And then around the holidays, we always do sketch comedy reviews where we have original sketches and we write them and produce them ourselves, perform them, obviously, like Saturday Night Live, but with a local flavor to them. We've been doing that for a long time as well. We do a lot of different things, and the Chicken Hat plays are just one example of that.
How long has Rubber Chicken been doing this?
Yeah, Rubber Chicken started in 2008, and so we've been doing a version of these Chicken Hat plays with another theater company, and then Rubber Chicken took them over. So that's why I say 20 years.
Well, in that time, you've had your ups and downs. I found some interesting news stories. One said you were retiring from the stage in 2015. I think you're still here. And another saying the producers of the movie Fargo said you should retire your production if it was going to parodize them.
Yeah, the Fargo thing was last year. What that was that's another fun thing that we had started to do called live reads. And you just get a classic movie script. You get some actors, and they just sit behind microphones and they recite the script. And believe it or not, it's really fun. It's a different way to see, you know, one of your favorite movies. And so what I always did over the years was, because I wasn't sure it wasn't a play, you know, where you apply for rights and you pay royalties and you get permission and all that stuff. So what I was doing over the years that we did live reads was I would write to movie studios. For example, Ghostbusters was Columbia Pictures at the time. We were going to do Ghostbusters, and I wrote to them. Now, usually what happened is they just never got back to me. And so I figured, all right, well, I've done my due diligence. The only one that ever got back to me was actually Columbia about Ghostbusters, and they said, you can't do it. And the woman was really nice. They got back to me in plenty of time. We had a nice conversation, and she said, actually, to get permission to do anything with Ghostbusters, you have to get not only the studio's permission, you have to get Bill Murray's permission, Dan Aykroyd's permission, you know, the estate of Harold Ramis. And I said, well, I'm not doing that much work, so we won't do that one. So what happened with Fargo was I did the same thing. Never heard. So, you know, we just move forward like we usually do. So we were getting ready to go. And then, yeah, a week before we were scheduled to do the live read, I got a huge cease and desist letter from the high-powered Los Angeles attorneys, just like, oh, my goodness. So obviously we didn't do it. But it would have been
the fact that you were, though, a local entry. I mean, the Coen brothers didn't say, oh, wait a minute, where is Duluth? We'll be right up there. We'll read with you. You didn't get that?
Yeah. We did not get that. And it's interesting you say that, though. I think that's probably why, of all the times we've done this, because the Coens and people that were involved in the movie, you know, are actors down the Twin Cities, it was more apt to be on somebody's radar and somebody let somebody know and they shut us down.
All right. Well, the Chicken Hat plays are the entire opposite. They're entirely new works. They're definitely owned by all the people you have doing them.
Yeah.
Eight directors, eight plays. Why eight?
Well, it's because over the years that we've been doing this, we've found some things that work really well, obviously, and then we're still learning things. But I always get feedback from all the participants, and so we kind of incorporate different things. And the reason for eight is because they want to shoot for about 10 minutes. And so when you get 8 10-minute plays and an intermission, it usually hits about 2 hours, and that's perfect length. So that's why we go four of the plays are in Act 1, and then you have your intermission, and then four of the plays in Act 2. So it's nice and even.
All right. So let's hear some of Rubber Chicken's work, because you don't actually have recordings of, you've done 311, you don't have a recording.
That's correct. We don't have any recordings of it, but we do have different things that I was able to share with you.
Well, I don't know how much of this was written on the spot, but it's supposed to sound improvised, I think. Here is a battle rap between Duluth Mayor Emily Larson and Superior Mayor Jim Payne, from the 2018 production by the Ensemble of Rubber Chicken Theater.
My name is Emily Larson, and I hope that you'll pardon me for laying down the truth of what's so great about Duluth. We got bike trails, boats with sails, and art all around. It brings tourists and purists to spend money in our town. Our hills are a beauty. We've got Edward Moody, the Amsoil Arena, our sister cities in Chiba. Your city's so flat, it's from the second dimension. Our jewel on the hill is too pretty to mention. Yo, it's me, Jim Payne, and I'm the talk of the town. Since I've taken office, all our problems are down. Your school board is, what more can I say? You think your city is pretty? Well, that's probably true, but pretty soon you'll learn how that joke is on you. You talk about the landscape and how we are inferior, but next to Duluth, we are always superior. Border Sports Bar and Grill, danger zone the main. Bars, 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 you'd think you were insane. Our college is demolished, you WS. But Cedar Lounge and Thirsty Pagan are nice, I guess. I can give you credit where credit is due. But do you have an aquarium or even a zoo? There's a reason people season up here in Duluth. In the summer, we got runners at those parks that are boots.
Duluth is really nice, but Superior's growing. And Emily, I think the cracks are really showing. We have drivable roads, you've got tons of potholes. Yeah, your infrastructure sucks, and that really blows.
Well, Jim, now I'm mad, so I think that I'm done. But there's one more thing before I have to run. Yeah, our town is on a hill, and there's dangers from erosion. But at least our town has never had a refinery explosion.
Ooh, and that was a Rubber Chicken Theater skit from 2018 of a battle rap between Duluth Mayor Emily Larson and Superior Mayor Jim Payne by the Ensemble of Rubber Chicken Theater. It's not quite one of the Chicken Hat plays, but it'll give you a flavor of what they're doing. What they are doing is the 20th anniversary edition of the Chicken Hat plays, which are 8 writers and 8 directors creating 8 world premiere plays in 24 hours. It'll be performed tomorrow night, June 24th, at Harbor City International School in Duluth. And we're speaking with the producer, director, head rubber chicken, Brian Matuszak. So wait a minute, does that mean that these are being written as we speak?
Well, it's Friday night is when the writers are going to start. Yeah, so that would be tonight, I guess. They'll be starting, we'll be kicking things off at 7 o'clock. The way it works is, just real quick, I'll let you know, it's very random. We have 3 hats. We have a who hat, a what hat, and a where hat. And we'll be taking prompts all week long. We've taken them all week long on Rubber Chicken social media. That's how I gather them ahead of time, and then I print them up and we throw them in the hats. And a who could be anything. It could be a person everybody knows, or it could be a position, you know, like a janitor or a principal or Lady Gaga, you know, whatever. All that goes in the who hat. Then what hat is just objects, you know, a telephone, a piece of paper, a rubber band, whatever, people, and you throw that in that hat. And then the where hat. And again, that could be specific as you want to say. If you want to say in Finland, you know, whatever, behind the garage, whatever, we've had some things like that. And so it's very random, and the writers draw one from each hat, and then I know going into the weekend how many actors we have, because that fluctuates, but I'll nail down that number Friday before we start, and I'll say you're writing for 4 performers, and so then they know they have to write for 4 performers, 4 characters, and then work those prompts into their play, and then they go off and write. Some go home, some don't. That's none of my business. Just show up Saturday morning at 8 o'clock with a finished script. And then we have the directors and the actors show up Saturday morning, and they randomly choose a script out of a hat. And then the cast randomly gets drawn out of a hat. And then the director and the actors go away, and they just rehearse all day long, learn lines, find props, find costumes. And then we present all 8 plays Saturday night at 7:30.
So it kind of sounds like the improv after hours at Second City or Dudley Riggs. Mm-hmm. I haven't been to Dudley Riggs in a few decades, so I don't know if they still do that. But Second City very much does that. That's what created them. In which, for people who haven't been there, you show up at the theater at midnight or, you know, after hours, and they ask the audience for pretty much exactly what you said. Mm-hmm. Name a vegetable, you know, name your favorite Matuszak family member, name whatever, something like that. And the audience throws it out, but the difference is the actors immediately go into a skit based on whatever it is you just said. All that happens instantaneously. So this almost seems like a hybrid between a completely thought-out play and what I just said.
Yeah, those are obviously gifted, made up on the spot, and people that can do that. And this is a little bit more of a play, although it's interesting. Sometimes it's like rehearsed improvisation, because sometimes people can do a great job. We've had actors over the years that it's amazing. They have it memorized by 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And some actors, most of the lines get out. and so it's always a mixed bag. But what I always tell actors, the audiences that come to see us when we do these hat plays, they know exactly the pressure that everybody involved has been under. And so as long as you're having fun, as long as you're trying, as long as you don't cry and walk off the stage and just quit, they're going to support you.
And what are some of the themes? You've got 311.
Well, it kind of depends on what you get for prompting. These plays,
the most memorable, though.
Yeah, well, I think the most memorable right away when people ask me that, I think about one we did set in a plane that was crashing on the way down, and there was a cowboy who had a lasso, and it was very heroic and funny and hilarious, and they saved the plane, and the audience cheered. It was just fantastic. You know, you see all sorts of fun things like that. Some people, they tend to be comedies just because we're, you know, a comedy theater. But I tell the writers, you know, if you want to go for something a little bit more poignant or strong, please do.
All right. Well, let's hear again some of your regular fare. Here's one from a few years back. It has a reference to now retired TV anchor Pat Kelly, but otherwise as fresh as, well, Lions Club pancakes.
All right, fellow Lions, listen up. This Thursday is our annual Duluth Lions Club pancake breakfast down at the deck. As you all know, attendance has been down the past few years. We need to see a spike up in those numbers this year, or we may have to cancel next year's event. I'm open to suggestions. Yeah, Johnson?
Instead of pancakes, we could serve spaghetti.
Sammy's already features breakfast spaghetti. Fezziwig.
How about a movie tie-in? Spider-Man is opening this weekend. We could put live spiders in every sixth pancake.
You're majorly creeping me out, Fezziwig. But I'm liking the movie idea. Gum Francis, what do you got?
We could have local celebrities serve the pancakes.
Yeah, are you forgetting last year's melted butter incident with Pat Kelly?
Ooh, how could I?
How could anyone? But what about a national celebrity? Wasn't Judy Garland from around here somewhere?
Grand Rapids.
Perfect.
Oh, there's just one problem, though. She's not around anymore. Why should that stop us?
Fezziwig, you're making my skin crawl. With delight. Someone get the Burt Lahr Estate on the phone. I've got a brainstorm and no umbrella. Let's make this a pancake day to remember.
Somewhere inside the deck.
Okay, what do you want? What do you want?
Welcome to the Duluth Cowardly Lions Club Pancake Breakfast.
One cake or two, one cake or two.
But I don't want any cake at all.
Ooh, oh, what'd you have to go and do that for? I wasn't gonna flip it.
Why, you're nothing but a coward.
Coward, eh? I'll show you. I can serve you with one paw tied behind my back. I can serve you on one foot if you want.
How am I supposed to eat these pancakes anyway?
I do believe in sporks. I do believe in sporks. If I were a king of the pancakes, not crepes, not waffles, not silk, I'd serve other things with my pancakes. A one bacon, a one sausage, a one milk.
Toto, I don't think we get seconds anymore.
And that was a Rubber Chicken Theater mashup of a lot of things. You might find similar fare or something completely different, but definitely new in his 20th anniversary performance of the Chicken Hat Plays. 8 writers, 8 directors, creating 8 world premiere plays in 24 hours and performed by some very intrepid actors. It'll be performed tomorrow night, June 24th, at Harbor City International School in Duluth. We are speaking with Brian Matusik from Rubber Chicken Theater, but you're not 8 people, so who else is involved?
Sure, there's a lot of folks and people. If you are exposed to a lot of Northland Theater, you'll recognize some of the names. Chris Nolet is going to be involved as an actor. He's very funny and does a lot of Playhouse shows and Rubber Chicken shows. My daughter, Kaylee, is going to be directing one, and that's really cool to see. She grew up with these plays. She used to, you know, take tiny little parts because I wanted to put her on stage because she really loved it. And then when she thought she could handle it, she actually acted a few times. And one thing that's fun, too, is a lot of folks that haven't done this for a while, but because it's our 20th anniversary, are going to come back and do it. Jack Sutherland is a Playhouse veteran. He did this a few years ago and had a ball, so he's going to come back and try it again. Ben Chadwick from Minneapolis is a tech theater person. He's going to try it for the first time. He thought it sounded fun, and he finally had an open weekend, so he's coming up from the cities to give it a try. Michael Vensky's another actor out of the cities who's been doing these almost every time we do them. He just loves coming up and it helps. He says it helps hone his craft. Sherry Tesarek, Sherry is a favorite. She's going to be directing this time, I believe. And former Duluth Mayor Don Ness will be writing for us this time. He wanted to try writing. And actually, he was a common cameo once where one person, you know, a local celebrity, has a little teeny part in all 8 plays. So we just give him a line or two and have some fun. And one time Don was a comic cameo, and boy, he had a blast.
Well, you know, he's also made his mark in Singing with the Stars.
That's right.
Which,
yep.
Unfortunately, yours truly had something to do with. So he's getting out there. I think we're finding a new career for the
Absolutely.
Former mayor. Where can we find out more information, get tickets and all that stuff?
Sure. Yep. You can call 218-213-2780 or rubberchickentheater.com. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and it's at Our Chicken Theater. Easy to find us.
Say them one more time.
218-213-2780, or you can just go to rubberchickentheater.com.
All right. We've been speaking with Brian Matusik of Rubber Chicken Theater. They'll be presenting the 20th anniversary edition of the Chicken Hat Plays. Eight writers, you should have this memorized by now, eight writers and eight directors creating eight world premiere plays in 24 hours. It'll be performed tomorrow night, June 24th at Harbor City International School in Duluth. Thank you for joining us, Brian Matusik.
All right. Thank you.
And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. Our theme song is written and produced by Bruce Nelson of South Range. I'm Robin Washington. Stay safe, everyone.
Simply Superior news and issues from a superior point of view. Gathered to mirror your life and interests with the goal of helping you to understand the world we live in and the region we hold dear. By sharing the stories and information, you'll enjoy and wonder.